Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're all here. All the ones who are here are here. And we're sorry those who couldn't make it aren't. But I'm really glad that you're all here. And as I said earlier, it's we're always happy to have people come and practice here at what we call Blue Mountain Zendo, because this is Blue Mountain that we are on the lower flank of, which means, of course, that we're very near the wild. We're also a bit in a weather zone, so you never know what's coming. Sometimes there'll be a sudden hailstorm, so it looks like it's going to be a changeable day.
He's going to come around and greet everyone, I think.
He's our bear warning system. He really doesn't like them. And he'll know that there's a bear around way before we do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So we've taken our theme for this retreat from a line written by Dogen Zenji. Dogen Zenji brought this form of Zen practice from China to Japan back in the 13th century. And he wrote a text called Genjo Koan, which is sometimes translated as Actualizing the Fundamental Point. I like to think of it as actualizing the fundamental koan, or paradox, of human life and consciousness, of self and world. But that's a bit wordy, so Genjo Koan is easier to say. And there's a line in it that goes, "In attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread." I have the Japanese upstairs. I forgot to bring it down. Several of you, or let's see, two of you who are here, have been doing a little study group on this text, which is how Kevin came to suggest our theme. And I jumped on it immediately. I really like the idea because we have flowers and we have lots of weeds here to practice with. In attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. What do you think that means? Somebody want to venture a paraphrase? Be brave.
In attachment, blossoms fall could mean that with attachment one destroys the beauty, the bloom, and in aversion weed spread could mean with resistance we cause obstacles.
There are different ways, there's no right or wrong here, there are different ways we could word this, and I encourage you to actually make your own wording in the course of today. Anybody else want to take a crack at it? Okay, I'll tell you what Suzuki Roshi says in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. This is how he paraphrases Dogen. Although everything has Buddha nature, we love flowers, and we do not care for weeds. A flower falls even though we love it. And a weed grows even though we do not love it. He goes on to comment, this is true of human nature. But that we are attached to some beauty is itself Buddha's activity. That we do not care for weeds is also Buddha's activity. We should know that. If you know that, it is all right to attach to something. If it is Buddha's attachment, that is non-attachment. There, so he turns it again.
Love that.
Yeah, yeah. So we can look at it one way, and then we can turn it and look at it the other way and open it up even more. I think what he's saying is not just, oh, okay, whatever. It's all Buddha. But that when we fully accept our humanity, with all our thousands of years of human karma and conditioning, when we feel love or desire, we can feel it also with a certain non-attachment, a certain just seeing it. Oh, wow, I really want that. Oh, haha. You know, we can feel it with a certain lightness. And when we feel aversion, even pretty strong aversion, there's also a certain measure of equanimity or acceptance. Acceptance might be a stretch, but we can just see it arising. Whoa, I really had a strong reaction to the negative reaction to that. In other words, we don't need to be repelled by our own aversive states of fear, grief, or anger. And we don't need to be driven by our desperate needs. So it's not about eliminating them, but about seeing them. Seeing our human life just as it is. The longer I practice, the more I see that if I can just stay with my experience, just as it is from moment to moment, with as much attention as I can, and as much patience and kindness as I can, whether that experience is of great beauty or deep anguish, I become more alive. And the aversive experiences, while they're certainly painful, have their own kind of vividness, even sometimes a kind of poignant beauty. So what's conventionally labeled ugly or beautiful, desirable or repellent, becomes more and more irrelevant. The words Dogen used in the English, translated into English as blossoms and weeds, I think are significant. The generic word for flower in Japanese is hana, but hana also frequently refers to cherry blossoms, which is the quintessential Japanese symbol of transient beauty. Beauty that is perfect and then goes with one big storm. The flower, the petals come swirling to the ground. They look like pink snow. And then they lie on the ground sometimes in kind of sodden piles. And they look like wet pink shells. And that's beautiful too, right? Maybe here on the West Coast we can appreciate the beauty and grandeur of a fallen great big red cedar or Douglas fir when they fall. The fallen giants and the way over decades their bodies decay and go to feed many species of forest life. They call them nurse logs. You've heard that expression, nurse logs. And you see this incredible life coming up from these decayed giant trees. But it's harder for us to let go, let alone find a gift in the many losses we encounter in life, from the most trivial to the most devastating. The word that's translated as weeds, kusa, is grass or grasses in Japanese. And that can, but it also refers to plant life in general. And when it's preceded by another character that means kind of mixed or miscellaneous, zaso, then it means more specifically weeds. In Zen terminology, though, grass refers to the stuff of our everyday lives, the karmic messiness, all the hindrances that obscure our clear mind and our open heart are called grasses. And Dogen is using the word in that sense too. If you've ever tried to weed grass out of a flower bed, you get the analogy. You can dig and pull until you think it looks pretty good, and the next year it's right back. So it's kind of like that with our hindrances, isn't it? You know, our confusions. So I think the grass analogy is a really good one. Now, the curious thing about weeds is that it's a totally arbitrary label, right? Dependent on our human needs and convenience and our cultural relationships to particular plant species. A weed is basically a wild plant that is growing where we don't want it to. Where we don't want it. And for that matter, cultivated plants can turn weedy and take over. There are a couple of, out in our garden, you might see what are called money plants or penny plants. You can dry them and they look kind of like coins, supposedly. And they seed themselves very freely, so they're kind of becoming a weed. We can't just leave them all. We just choose certain ones to keep. And there's a kind of blue geranium out there, likewise, that I'm always pulling out. The columbines, on the other hand, mostly I let them spread around as they wish. You'll see. You'll get a sense when you go out and you can look at how things have... Because we're not very... we're not garden control freaks. Things kind of spread themselves. Some plants that are considered weeds in our urban-suburban culture are valued as nutritious food sources or for their medicinal healing properties in other cultures. The dandelion is the most obvious case in point. For centuries in Europe and early North America, it was valued as a spring tonic. You know, the first greens to get those vitamins in the spring, in salads and cooked greens. And the root used as a kind of coffee, dandelion wine, for that matter, is another use. Lots of uses for dandelions. Only when the value of having a uniform green lawn as a symbol of middle-class prosperity came into our culture did dandelions become a nuisance plant to be combated with noxious poisons. If you look around many vegetable gardens, you might find chickweed, lamb's quarters, purslane. If you grew up in the city, you probably even don't know those names, but you learn them when you start gardening. But all of them are perfectly good additions to a spring salad. Probably more nutritious than lettuce from the supermarket. Definitely more nutritious than lettuce from the supermarket. Because weeds can be particularly good at drawing valuable minerals up from the soil. So it's a terrible waste to eradicate them with weed killer rather than returning them to the soil, either through composting them or as what's called green manure, where you turn them under to rot back into the soil. The kind of weeds that we find in our garden can tell us a lot about the quality of the soil. whether it's acid or alkaline, what its water retention is like, what the drainage is, and the fertility. Acidic soil will often have sheep sorrel and sourgrass, which actually taste sour. They're also good in salad. And horsetail. How many people know what horsetail looks like? Well, we'll have to show you. Horsetail dates has relatives going back to the Carboniferous era, before their flowering plants even existed. And it doesn't look like a horsetail, really. It looks more fern-like. Native peoples used it, they called it scouring rush, because it scours clay pots or pans clean. I always meant to try it, see if it really does. But horsetail indicates boggy soil, poorly drained soil. Okay, how many know what stinging nettle is? Have you ever been stung? Stinging nettle, also a very nutritious spring green, grows in deep, rich soils. And it's one of the highest sources of vitamins A and B, A and C and B complex, as well as being very high in protein and a better nitrogen source than most commercial fertilizers. The legendary Tibetan saint, Milarepa, is said to have survived his years of solitary meditation in the mountains by eating nettles until he turned green. So you will see Tibetan tankas, those detailed Tibetan Buddhist paintings, picturing him sitting at the entrance to his cave, holding his hand to his ear to hear the cries of the world from way up there at his cave. And he's a beautiful green color. I read this story in a chapter of a wonderful book called Gardening at the Dragon's Gate, At Work in the Wild and Cultivated World, by Wendy Johnson, who was the head gardener at San Francisco Zen Center's Green Gulch Farm for many, many years. She points out that for all its marvelous properties, the nettle does not adapt well to cultivation. No one succeeded in making it a cultivated vegetable, because it grows from perennial rhizomes that extend rather deeply underground. It doesn't grow from seeds well. She says every year, as it sends up new tendrils from the underworld in the spring, the stinging nettle is a yearly reminder that it is far too ancient and dynamic a plant ever to be tamed. So I kind of like that. The nettle can't be tamed. And then there are the flowers, right? Most people love flowers and appreciate having them around. Some people go to great lengths and expense to grow perfect specimens and develop unusual varieties. But some beautiful flowers, some pretty things, are poisonous, right? Some of the things we most wish for sometimes turn out to be poisonous. The most common example here is foxglove, or digitalis, and there's some outside, which has the potential to induce a fatal heart attack, even in very small amounts. It's another one that we just let seed. We never planted it. It's wild along, it's spread along roadsides. You can see it throughout BC. And we always let some grow for the flowers, wherever they come up, so you'll see them. But it's good to be able to recognize them so you don't mix it into your spring salad. However, foxglove has long been used as a folk remedy in England, in Europe. In 1775, a doctor named William Withering did a series of experiments using it to treat congestive heart failure. He wasn't successful, but his work broke the ground for later investigation, which led to the use of digitalis as now a common heart, a common remedy or treatment for heart disease. So poison in very small doses can be therapeutic, can serve as medicine, right? What does this tell us about the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion? Refined and purified of self-clinging, each of those becomes a medicine, turns from poison to medicine. Greed is transformed into caring and compassion, because at the core of greed is a caring energy. But it's just when it's contaminated by self-focus that excludes the world that it becomes poisonous. Hatred or aversion is transformed into what's called discriminating wisdom, clear seeing, you know, when it's purified of that self-focus, that defending of the self. And ignorance, you know, turning away, I don't want to deal with it, is turned into equanimity. So that clear seeing with equanimity and care, the three all balance each other. So going back to foxglove for a minute, it's not native to North America. It has spread originally from Europe, introduced. And that raises the question of alien species, invasive alien species. Dandelions again. Dandelions aren't from here. Who'd have thought? You know. The elegant rainforest banana slug rarely does any harm in our garden. They stay in the forest. Although once I found one climbing the wall of the house, eating that kind of algae that grows on vinyl siding. The slug was rasping at me, eating the slime. But the slugs that do so much damage to gardens, then there are three or four different varieties at least, they're all from Europe. They all came over on ships and spread and spread and spread. They particularly love the brassicas, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, etc. Back in the early 1970s when I was an organic farmer in New Brunswick in eastern Canada, by the Bay of Fundy, it could be, the fog could come in the summertime and it could be very wet. And I remember stepping out by my garden in the evening one night and hearing the slugs eating my brassicas. It sounded like this. So what does one do about slugs if one has taken a vow of non-harming? Well, I confess, I gathered them up and fed them to the chickens in those days. Now, what we do is take a yogurt container and some chopsticks and gather up the slugs and relocate them across the street. But that's harder to do on a large scale, in a large scale operation. No matter how organic, no matter how strictly vegan you might be, beings die as the result of our agricultural activities, you know, to provide food for us. We can do what we can to minimize the harm we do, but ultimately, we need to take a wide and long view that sees how life and energy are continuously being transformed from one form to another, including our bodies. In Japan, at least when we lived there, which was a long time ago now, we were at a university that was about an hour and a half north of Tokyo surrounded by agricultural areas in Ibaragi-ken. And we learned that there was still a ceremony done in late summer of in which the farmers would express gratitude and sort of a sense of apology to the beings that died as a result of farming every year. At Green Gulch Farm and San Francisco Zen Center, they've developed a ceremony that they do yearly based on that one. And I'd like to find out more about it and maybe do it here. So I thought we might consider some parallels with how our cultural attitudes towards so-called plant or animal species, alien plant or animal species, compare with attitudes toward immigrants or refugees, legal or illegal. As long as they serve the interests of the dominant culture, they are encouraged, right? You know, like sometimes certain plants or animals were deliberately brought here and then become out of balance. That very argument is used for people. Too many, too fast, right? But we also have to look at the intentions. When refugees and immigrants are welcomed, sometimes it's only as long as they serve the interests of the dominant culture, often with conditions attached. And when they become a threat, we look for ways to eliminate them or send them home. You know, that's so often the kind of vicious go back where you came from line that is used. But from the perspective of First Nations peoples, the whole European colonial population could be seen as a massively invasive alien species. Right? So this is not to say that that we shouldn't exercise some control over plant and animal species that get out of balance and start to harm native species. But it's certainly, it's important to be discerning about that. But it's to raise the complexity of this whole question, you know, of what is a native species? How does something become indigenous? Because, of course, species came to North America and moved around continents when continents were connected that are no longer connected, for example. Yeah, so we need to be able to take a long and deep view and still make skillful decisions in specific circumstances. So I'm not just talking about the garden, remember. But over the many years of gardening that I've spent and the wandering through fields and forests that I've done since childhood, I've observed the permeable boundaries between the wild and the cultivated realms. How quickly the wild takes over from our small clearings and large clearings and even our paved parking lots. You can go to the States, probably more than Canada, and see decaying, abandoned malls. And the wild moves in. quite quickly. There's a book called The World Without Us. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I'll actually get it out upstairs so that you can look at the cover. The painting on the cover is a picture of New York City without people after maybe 20, 30 years. How dramatically the structures and systems we humans have created would break down without our continuous maintenance. He gives very specific examples. A sobering book, very sobering book. But also kind of marvelous to think, you know, there's incredible energy and resilience of particularly the plant world. Yeah. In just these 2 acres that Michael and I have inhabited for the last 12 years, we have faced decisions about how to balance the wild and the cultivated. Sometimes we inherit karma from those who have gone before us, right? We're born into a particular family. Sometimes we feel like, I didn't ask to be in this family. What am I doing here? And we're born into the larger systems of our culture and our world. You'll see when you go outside a weedy patch in the rear of our yard. This is where the people before us had made a garden. Apparently they grew potatoes there. So the first year, since it was expedient, we used it. But it was shady and wet, not well drained, so we tried to build up, just mound up the dirt into raised beds. But it still, it wasn't a very good garden. So gradually we built raised beds, as you'll see, and decommissioned the old garden. But we continued to use it as a kind of holding area for plants that we'd pick up at plant sales, and we didn't really know where to put them yet. So there's still some remnants there. We've got most of them moved out into other places. There's a hazelnut tree that's grown too big to move. And a few other things out there. There's a continuously expanding clump of comfrey. Is it becoming a weed? We couldn't mow that weed patch because of the lumpy raised beds we'd made. And we were too busy with the rest of the garden to do anything about it. So the patch has been growing up in buttercup. Please don't sample buttercup. That's another poisonous thing. Horsetail, salmon berries. We keep saying we'll level it out and return it to yard status. Why not leave it as it is? Well, one reason is that when we moved here, we brought a number of plants from our old garden, including some clumps of chives, which we planted in the patch. And along with the chives came a highly invasive plant called field bindweed, also white root. Again, from Europe, it's a kind of morning glory with a beautiful white flower, but it grows by sending out deep white rhizomes, kind of like nettle does. So you just cannot get rid of it. You cannot pull it out. And it's spread throughout that patch, and I don't want it to spread further. But we're perpetually behind with garden work, so somehow the wild patch stays at the back of the yard and at the bottom of the list. In the meantime, we watch how the wild creatures gravitate there. The deer love to browse, and the bears come snuffling through, and our cats go there to hunt mice and shrews and voles and moles. It's their little jungle. The messy weed patch is full of life. Another dilemma. There's a black walnut tree out there that our predecessors planted. It has now matured and is producing nuts. They're a food source, but it takes half an hour to crack a half cup of walnuts to make cookies. And we are not hunter-gatherers who can spend hours cracking nuts during the off-season. If the walnut tree is to have room to grow, we should probably remove a native hemlock, which is crowding it from one side. Beneath the walnut tree are some blueberry bushes. Again, planted not by us, and they've never produced very well. They're rather shaded, but becoming more shaded, and they will probably be gradually poisoned by the walnut tree because black walnuts poison everything beneath them. What to do? Which plant do we value most? Or do we not do anything and see how it unfolds? We don't start with a blank slate in life. We come into this messy weed patch of a world, and if we keep our Dharma eye open, we find great beauty and great destruction right before us. We find disease, thorns and flowers, sometimes on the same plant, and sometimes we find healing and connection in the most unexpected places. So I hope you can see that these examples are akin to what happens in our daily lives as we try to sort out the weeds from the flowers and make skillful and careful decisions without being rigid and doctrinaire. Seeing deeply that in attachment, flowers fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. So I'll stop here.